Okay, so welcome back to the Private Pilot Podcast. Today, I've got a very special thing for you. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Fokker Aircraft Company, and I'm also going to talk some about... I'm going to have a friend, rather, on who's a pilot with an airline, who's going to talk a little bit about working for the airlines, and a little bit about his own flying experience. So I'm just going to start right in here on the Fokker Aircraft Company. The company was actually founded back in 1912, and a lot of you may recognize Fokker, the name anyways, because it was very big in World War I, and also somewhat in World War II. It was a conglomeration, collaboration, between Fokker, Anthony Fokker, and Hugo Junkers, another very famous name in aviation, that led to some very early good results, such as the Fokker Eindecker 3, the Fokker DR1, and of course the Fokker D7. The DR1, of course, being the infamous plane of the Red Baron, the one that everyone associates with him, even though it wasn't the primary airplane that he used. But that's the Tridecker that everyone associates with him. It also... gained infamy in World War I because Fokker was one of the ones that came up with the synchronization gear that let the machine gun fire through the propeller. This of course gave the Germans a massive air superiority, and at one point or another the Fokker was known as the Fokker Scourge during World War I. In 1919 Fokker actually returned to the Netherlands. It was started as a Dutch company, and He basically separated from Junkers at this point and started his own company near Amsterdam and built a whole bunch of aircraft. For example, the Finnish Air Force took a whole bunch of them, the C-5, the C-10, and the D-21. And the 1920s was sort of the glory years for Fokker. He had his the Fokker Trimotor, the F7, which was used by 54 different airline companies, which was a very, very famous airplane. And it even managed to capture 40% of the American market in 1936, and dominated the European market until the arrival of the more... prominent all-metal American and German aircraft in the mid-1930s. One of the biggest blows to Fokker was actually a TWA disaster, Flight 599 in Kansas. Newt Rockne was one of the casualties in that flight, and as a result of that, all Fokkers were grounded in the United States. In 1923, he moved to the United States, where he established his American branch, which was known as the Atlantic Aircraft Corporation, and renamed in 1927 to the Fokker Aircraft Corporation of America. He merged in 1930 with General Motors, and the new name would then become the General Aviation Manufacturing. In World War II, the German factories were confiscated by the Germans. And they were used to build the Bucher's Bu-181 Bestmann, and also parts for the Junkers U-52. By the end of the war, these factories had been completely destroyed, either through the Germans stripping them or the Allied bombings. After World War II, he had a hard time rebuilding. What eventually wound up happening was in 1958, he introduced his most successful airliner ever. This is sort of where Fokker once again came into the forefront. The F-27, the Fokker F-27, was known as the Friendship. And it was one of the most used twin-engine turboprops, and is still considered the world's most successful turboprop airplane. This was followed in 1962 with the Fokker F-28 Fellowship. and production was stopped on that in 1987. In 1969, they agreed to an alliance between the Bremen-based Vereinige Flugschnitzwerke, which collaborated on an unfortunate unsuccessful jetliner, the VFW 614, of which only 19 were sold. They were one of the main partners in the F-16 consortium, and were responsible in that consortium for the production of the F-16 Fighting Falcon. In 67, they started a modest space division and built a lot of parts for European satellites, and are still building parts for European satellites today through the European Space Agency, and also built pressurized modules for Spacelab. They had a brief collaboration with McDonnell Douglas in the 1980s, and then they began their own ambitious project to develop new aircraft, including the Fokker 50, which was a modernized version of the F-27, the Fokker 100, which was an aircraft based on the F-28's design. In 1996, the board directors of Daimler-Benz, who had since acquired Fokker, decided to focus on its core area of automotive manufacture, and basically bankrupted the company. It was declared bankrupt on March 15th, 1996. Those divisions of the company that manufacture the parts still carried out maintenance and repair work, and were taken over by what is now known as Stork Aerospace Group. Stork Fokker exists basically to sustain and the remarketing of the company's existing aircraft. They refurbish and resell the F-50s and the F-100s. There is a new company out there now called Rykoff Aircraft. It's actually Fokker spelled backwards. And they are attempting to restart the production of the Fokker 70MT, which is supported by various suppliers and airlines. So that basically then is a quick overview of the Fokker Aircraft Corporation. And I'm going to bid you adieu for a few seconds while I prep my guest to come on and speak to you. So I look forward to talking to you again in a few seconds. The Private Pilot Podcast, and as promised earlier in the show, I am going to give you a chance to, well, give me rather a chance to interview another friend of mine. This is Dave. Dave flies for SkyWest.
How y'all doing there?
Well, hopefully that they're all doing fine and they're all waving at their screens right now like, you know, like idiots and all that fun stuff. Dave is a friend of mine. He is a first officer for SkyWest?
That's correct.
And you are also a CFI, CFII, MEI, all that fun stuff?
Affirmative.
Cool. So, Dave can tell you how to fly, too.
Was an instructor out for 4 years out in Daytona Beach, Embry-Riddle, Aeronautical University, my alma mater.
Ooh. So he's got a degree in flying, too. He's special. So what got you into flying?
It was something I wanted since day one. I can remember being out in El Paso, Texas, on my parents' house, pointing to little flying things in the sky, and saying, "Ooh, mommy, look at that! Ooh, daddy, look at that!" So, ever since then, I always wanted to fly.
Okay, so you grew up, surprisingly.
Sure, I'd like to call it that.
You made it through infancy.
Mm-hmm.
Then you went off to college. You went and did your flight training at Embry-Riddle. Now, did you do all of it at Embry-Riddle, or did you do any of it beforehand?
I did everything all the way up to CFI at Embry-Riddle. And CFI, II, and MEI, I went off campus just to save a little time and chump change.
Okay.
It got very, very, very expensive, you know, and honestly, you know, Riddle is not one of the cheapest places to go, but for a real structured facility and well-maintained equipment, it's second to none.
Now, Embry-Riddle, one of their, if I understand the entire situation correctly, one of their things that they promise is, come to us if you want to be an airline pilot, and we'll churn you out the door, and you'll be set to go and be hired by an airline.
Well,
doesn't work that way.
Well, it's a very involved and complicated process, okay? What they have based on is the fact that most people go to Riddle and they want to be airline pilots. So they structure their training around that. Okay. Most FBOs, like the one that you're flying at.
That would be a fixed base operator for those of you who, or fuel based operator, depending on which definition you're going by.
they're more in line to getting your certificate. Okay, and getting it as fast and as cheap as possible. Nothing wrong with that, and that's how I went as far as my CFI course was concerned, because at the time I didn't have very much money, so I needed it very quick and as cheaply done as possible. And personally, it's a good way to it was good for me to step out of the structured lifestyle that Riddle had, and go to a Part 61 to get my hands a little bit dirty, if you will. You know, because there were more things outside of the structured facility, and certain situations came up, you know, where it wasn't outlined in any SOPs or training manual.
Right.
And I'm very grateful to that I took a certain portion of my training in a Part 61 facility.
Okay. But now you're an airline pilot.
Yes.
So you're obviously one of those people that makes, you know, over $100,000 a year, right?
Not yet.
You mean pilots don't make over $100,000 a year?
No, it doesn't start out that way.
I'm shocked, I tell you. Shocked, and in case you people are unfamiliar with sarcasm, my voice is dripping with it right now.
Well, for starters, depending on which airline you go, on average, first year you're making about $20,000 to $25,000 a year as a first officer at a regional. But there is hope. Depending on who you work for. Some have slower attrition rates than others. So if you remain a first officer, you're likely to see like $8 to $10 dollar an hour increases. So let's say your first year you're making $24 an hour. Then all of a sudden you wind up making somewhere along the neighborhood of $33 or $34 an hour, which, you know, adds up to a nice little piece of chump change.
Well, now you're pushing $66 a year. $66,000 a year. So yeah. Makes a difference. Well,
there's also a legal limit for how much we can fly too. So.
Well, yes, granted. But anyways, a lot of the people that listen to this show, at least I think, and I can't tell based on the listener statistics, because there's no way for me to pull up what kind of pilot's licenses you people have. Unless you send me your full name and then I can go search the FAA database. But I'm assuming that at least some of my listeners are people who are looking to learn how to fly and possibly considering careers in aviation. How would they go about, or how would someone like myself go about getting a job with, say, an airline?
Well, for one thing, just make sure that you have that overall desire.
Okay, well, make the assumption that I have the overall desire. By the way, for those of you listening, I have no such dreams like that at all. I'm happy if my charter company gets set up, but that's a different issue. And I'll talk to you all about that at a later date. But back to the airline thing. Assume that I have the desire to work for an airline.
Okay. There are several ways to go about it. How I did it was when I got my commercial certificate, I immediately went into an internship with Transworld Airlines back in the summer of 2000, and I was able to work at the dispatch office and saw how an airline really worked.
For those of you who don't know, by the way, and I'll go into this at a later date, Transworld Airlines was originally set up by Howard Hughes.
So
that was the big competitor to Pan Am. So, sorry about that.
Oh.
I feel I have to share history with these people, because, you know,
sure.
People don't know history.
Sure. Might not even know TWA even existed, so.
It was Juan Tripp who ran Pan Am?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So, all right.
So, as far as the airlines are concerned, you've got a couple of big ways of going at it. The most common way is to obtain your commercial certificate and then become a CFI, which, you know, when you become a CFI, you learn a lot of things, you know, and it makes you a better pilot. And I was very happy to be a flight instructor for 4 years, and I'm still, you know, happy that I can have the ability to teach anybody to fly.
Now, we had my old flight instructor, Alex, who's actually still my flight instructor, now teaching me instrument training, on here for the last show. And it seems just, as sort of in a joking manner, one of the things that you learn as a CFI is all the new and fascinating ways your students can kill you.
Well, it keeps you on your toes.
I'm sure it does.
That's all I can say.
So anyway, so you went and you got your CFI, and then what?
Well, I built up time for 4 years.
How much time is required?
To be a airline pilot, I've seen the requirements as low as 600 hours. 600 hours total, at least 100 of it multi-engine time.
Which is what most of the schools go by?
Well, that's for a few airlines that I know of. Mm-hmm. On average, they're looking at about 10 to 1,200 hours with 100 to, call it 200 multi.
Okay. So the schools, so when you then go to a school like, say, Embry-Riddle, are they concentrating on getting you the total time? Are they concentrating on getting you the multi-time? What are they concentrating on?
Well, in the case of Embry-Riddle, they're more concentrated into getting your certificates.
Okay.
And then when you become a flight instructor, there's where you start building time.
Okay.
All right, so more commonly, you have people going that route to become airline pilots. They get their commercial certificates, and then they become flight instructors and build time until they have enough hours to throw out their resumes and hopefully get the interview. Or we've also had our fair share of people coming to Riddle and getting their certificate ratings and going into the armed forces.
Another good way to build time.
Correct. So, and we also had the ROTC program. So once they graduated and they had all their certificates, they immediately became officers.
Well, yeah, that's the only way to fly with any of the armed forces nowadays.
Right.
Even so
it just made things a lot easier versus starting from the ground up.
I mean, even the Army no longer lets you fly as a warrant officer. I don't think, although I could still be wrong on that, but I think that the Army recently instituted you have to be an officer, and plus the Army got rid of all their planes. They only have helicopters. And
correct.
They suck, so. all pilots think helicopters suck.
So
from helicopter pilots.
The most common ways to build your time is to become a CFI, flight instructor, or you can go the military route. And, you know, there are, if you're lucky enough to land, like, some other corporate job or commercial or Part 135 racket. And again, that's, you know, very rare, but it does happen that you can build up your time pretty quickly as well.
Now,
I seem to remember back in the 80s when I was flying a lot as a passenger, that every single pilot out there was a military pilot. It just seemed that at one point or another, that was the easiest way to get your privilege to fly commercially for a lot of the airlines. And, you know, a lot of them seem to not only be former military, but still be like in the, you know, Air National Guard Reserve kind
right,
of thing.
Right, right.
Have you noticed a change in that in the past few years?
Well, there's a little bit more. There's some pilots who, you know, just who started out as flight instructors, and you know they're coming up. The reason why most of these pilots went the military was because it was the easiest, cheapest way of getting your certificates and building up time.
Yeah, assuming you don't mind signing away 4 or 5 years of your life to
right,
to Uncle Sam or your own country's.
I stayed away from that for personal reasons, but that's not the issue here. So, but my airline, most of the people that are flying started as flight instructors, and then got on board. Other corporate jobs, or even fly-by-night cargo operations. Yes, there are certain operations that that you can fly cargo in the wee hours of the night, and you can build up time. And they have some bigger, faster airplanes too. And it's only like a handful at SkyWest Airlines that are indeed military pilots. The big carriers tend to hire from the military. However, I just found out, I was talking to a couple of our captains who were just hired by Southwest, that they're starting to hire a lot from the regionals. It used to be, like you said, back in the 80s, that a good portion did indeed come from the military. Well,
I remember that SAS was one of those where if you weren't a member of the Swedish, Danish, or Norwegian Air Force, you just didn't work for them.
Yeah, some Asian carriers are like that too. But because of the advent of CRM, which is crew resource management, they want they essentially want pilots who, you know, not just military pilots, but all types of pilots essentially, because getting two pilots of the same origin, you know, may not be the best in certain situations.
Right.
And you want that healthy mix.
So
they're starting to, so instead of being exclusive to the military, it's being more inclusive to other pilots.
Okay. So once you have your nice cushy job, as I think Eddie Rickenbacker, the founder of Eastern Airlines, called airline captains bums on seats, if I remember correctly. So once you have this nice cushy job of as a bum on a seat, because I mean, for the most part, I'm assuming most of the flying is done by autopilot. I realize that there are people who still like to hand fly their airplanes, but I realize that most airline pilots, you take off, you turn on the autopilot, and you keep flying, and then it basically brings it down and lands it for you for the most part.
Well. For us, we have to disengage by 200 feet.
Okay, so it brings it down to 200 feet, and then you got 200 feet left to free fall. Cool. But all joking aside, though, once you have this job and you're moving forward as an airline, as a first officer, I'm guessing that they're not going to put you in a 777 your first day.
Well, what it is what I had to do, and it pretty much, you know, falls in line with most training, is they'll put you in They'll start you off in ground school. It's about 3.5 weeks. They'll go through a process called indoctrination, where they teach you the rules and the regulations of airline operations, and then you go through emergency procedures training and limitations of the airplane that you got assigned to, and then they start about 1.5 to 2 weeks of systems. Once that's said and done, then you go through what's called a flight training device, or FTD, to teach you procedures, flows, and just to get you warmed up for the simulator. And depending on whether you're a first officer or captain, captains obviously being their duration in the sim is longer, you go through a week to 10 days of sim. And once you get through that, then you get one checkout flight in the real thing. And it's just an empty plane. You go out to a remote area, practice takeoffs, landings, approaches, maybe an emergency or two. And then once that's over, then you go through something called initial operating experience, or IOE. And this is where you are flying with a company check airman, just to make sure that you're pretty much on your game.
Okay, so then you become a first officer, I guess. In your case, how long do you remain a first officer once you're in that position? I mean, are you going to be a first officer for life? Are you going to be a first officer for 2 years, 3 years?
Me personally, I foresee myself maybe a year and a half or so. And that's because I'm fortunate enough to land at SkyWest, where it's such a high attrition rate, because people are moving out of the EMB-120, which I fly, and they're moving into the Canada Regional Jet, or they're just upgrading. So my seniority increased to number 2 out of Fresno.
Okay.
So... and going back to what I was saying, it all depends on who you work for. Some have, like SkyWest, I could easily become a captain in less than 2 years, while some have a wait of 7 to 10 years before upgrading to captain.
Okay. So there's hope.
Yes.
Okay, well, Dave, I want to thank you, because we're pushing a lot of time here. You've been talking for a while. I'm going to have Dave back on a later show, since Dave is coming on board with me for Zephyr Air. It's going to be our chief operating officer once we get up and running. So I'm going to have him come back at a later date, and we'll talk some about the charter industry. But until then, it has been once again my pleasure to bring you the Private Pilot Podcast, and I hope that all of your flyings are safe ones. So have safe and happy flyings.